What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Have you heard all the stories on the news lately about cold cases being solved by forensic genealogy? Are you fascinated by unsolved mysteries that you wish could be answered? Are you intrigued by DNA technology and its application to cold murder cases? Or do you just love a good story with a satisfying ending? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I have the podcast for you. DNA ID is the only true crime podcast dedicated exclusively to cold cases solved by forensic genealogy. On my show, you'll get all the behind-the-scenes details on how these cases were brought to closure and how the victims finally got justice. Listen to DNA ID Season 3 starting January 16, 2023, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Citizen Detective, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons,
DNA ID,
Scene of the Crime,
Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Citizen Detective is recorded live alongside real-life citizen detectives.
Welcome to another episode of Citizen Detective. I'm one of your hosts, Mike Morford. My friends call me Morph. I host several true crime podcasts, including Criminology, The Murder of My Family, Missing Persons, and Zodiac Speaking, probably a couple more. But if you'd like to leave us a voicemail for tonight's case, we'd love to hear from you, and we may play it on the air. So go over to speakpipe.com/citizendetective. Let us know what's on your mind. And with that, I'm going to turn you over to Alex.
Thanks again, Morph. I'm Alex Ralph, researcher and writer for Citizen Detective and the doc show Murder Was the Case. I am a law graduate with 15 years experience in criminal law, working both prosecution and defense in homicide cases and other violent crimes. Just to remind everyone where you can find us, we are live right now on YouTube, twitch.tv/citizendetective, twitter.com/citizendpod, and facebook.com/citizendetectivepodcast.
Hi, I'm Doc Murder. I am the author of Cool North Killers, Rampage, Homicide, a Forensic Psychology Casebook, Understanding Necrophilia, just to name a few. I have a PhD in the interdisciplinary study of atypical homicide and sex crimes, much more, but that's not important. What is important is people. You got to go to patreon.com/citizendetective. You got to join the DDA, the Digital Detective Agency. We can't do it alone. We're just mere mortals. But if we collect this, if we crowdsource these investigations and harness it using the powers of the interweb together, we can achieve something truly remarkable one day. And if not, we'll have a lot of fun. So what are we doing today? What is the case, guys?
Actually, Morph, if you want to talk a little bit about the website?
Yeah, just a quick plug for our website. Anyone that wants to learn about what's going on with the show, get updates, comment on different episodes, find all the episodes in one spot, head over to citizendetectivepodcast.com. It's your one-stop shop for everything Citizen Detective, so please go check it out. And now back over to Alex.
Tonight we head back to Virginia, to the small town of Oak Level. On the morning of August 15th, 2002, Chris Thompson arrived at the home of his employer and friend, Michael Short. They were ready to continue work on a project from the night before. Instead, Thompson found Michael dead from a single gunshot wound to the head. When police arrived, they found the body of Michael's wife, Mary Short. Mary was alone in bed, also the victim of one shot to the head. There were no signs of robbery at the Short home, but one thing was indeed missing. Michael and Mary's 9-year-old daughter, Jennifer, was nowhere to be found. Search efforts failed to find any clues as to Jennifer's whereabouts, but the state of her room indicated that someone abducted her from her bed. 6 weeks later, a family found Jennifer's remains approximately 30 miles away in Rockingham County, North Carolina. 23 years later, no one has been charged with the murders of the Short family, although law enforcement claims they have evidence that points to multiple persons of interest in the case. One suspect includes a Rockingham County man whose landlord called the authorities with information that sparked an international manhunt. The investigation into the murders remains open and active, with a task force dedicated to finding the individual or individuals responsible. This case is rich with information, and we cannot possibly include every detail in tonight's summary. We will, however, make every attempt to cover additional information during the discussion and during the scrum. So with that, let's go back to Morph, and he can get us started.
Founded in 1977 and named for founding father Patrick Henry, Henry County, Virginia sits in the south-central area of the state. The county spans 384 square miles with a current population of just over 50,000 residents. Within Henry County lies the tiny town of Oak Level. Contained within Bassett, Virginia, Oak Level is a largely rural microcity whose population has dwindled over the decades to less than 500 people. Most Oak Level citizens own their own homes, and homes have a median price of $116,000, nearly half the national average. Oak Level consists largely of lower to middle class families just trying to get by from paycheck to paycheck. Route 220 runs through the center of town, connecting Martinsville in the south to Roanoke, 40 miles south. Michael and Mary Short lived in Oak Level with their 9-year-old daughter, Jennifer. The family lived in a red brick house right on Route 220. This neighborhood wasn't typical of the residential area, in that Route 220 is a busy four-lane highway lined by cheap, run-down motels and gas stations. The Shorts only had one neighbor who lived approximately 300 feet away. Next to the Short residence, about 100 yards away, were the Circle C Motel and Circle C Convenience Store. The Shorts shopped there often. Jennifer visited the store frequently enough to become friends with the owner, Lorraine St. Clair. Next to the Circle C was an abandoned farm stand. A flea market and junkyard sat across from the Shorts' house. The Shorts were a close family and well-liked in the community. Michael's sister, Carolyn Short, describes the family as a happy one who largely kept to themselves. Michael was the owner of MS Mobile Home Movers, a company that relocated mobile and manufactured homes in Virginia. At the time of her death, Mary Short did books for Michael's moving company. Michael was a committed husband and father who worked hard for his family. Jennifer was a shy kid with freckles, brown hair, and a beautiful smile. She was looking forward to starting the fourth grade at Figsboro Elementary in the fall. According to her school counselor, Tammy Joyce, Jennifer was a role model for other students. The soon-to-be fourth grader played softball and took dance classes, and she loved playing Barbies.
On the morning of Thursday, August 15th, 2002, Michael's employee, Chris Thompson, arrived at the Short home. He and Michael were supposed to take a trip to buy another truck for the company. Chris was at Michael's place the night before, helping to repair one of the company trucks. Thompson arrived at Michael's home at 9 a.m. and parked his car. As he approached the house, he thought it odd that Michael was not outside waiting for him. The house was quiet, and the garage door was open. He entered the garage through the open door and found Michael lying on his back on an old couch he kept in the garage. As Thompson got closer, he realized Michael was dead from a large gunshot wound to his head. Thompson immediately called police. Deputies from the Henry County Sheriff's Office arrived at the scene with guns drawn. Deputies searched the home and found Mary Short in bed, also dead from a single shot to the head. The Henry County Sheriff's Office had jurisdiction over the case. Searching inside the home, investigators found a bag on the kitchen counter containing $485 in cash. The bag, as well as a check for $211, were in plain sight, available for the taking. Police quickly concluded that robbery was not the motive for the murders. Deputies also found a 12-gauge Winchester shotgun and a .22 caliber rifle, both owned by the Shorts. Neither gun was the murder weapon, presumed to be a .22 caliber or other small caliber gun. Officers did not find the murder weapon anywhere at the scene. While the cash and weapons were not taken by the intruder, there was one thing missing. 9-year-old Jennifer was nowhere to be found. At first, deputies thought Jennifer fled the home when she heard the gunshots and was maybe hiding somewhere outside. By afternoon, they had a new theory. When a sweep of the area failed to produce the girl, investigators looked in the house for evidence of what happened. Entering Jennifer's bedroom, they found several signs that Jennifer was the victim of an abduction. Jennifer's bedding was pulled down, indicating she had been in bed at one point and gotten up. Additionally, the mattress was out of place, moved approximately 2 inches from its original position. Jennifer's pillow was on the floor. There was no blood or other evidence that Jennifer was harmed in the home, but the state of the room indicated a struggle, reinforcing the abduction theory. As far as we know, no information is available as to whether the house was forcibly entered. Those who knew the Shorts advised that the family was less than vigilant about securing their home. Perhaps a window or a door was left unlocked, enabling the intruder to enter the home easily. Outside the house, crime scene investigators found the phone lines severed. The offender clearly wanted to ensure that no one inside the home would be able to call for help.
The night before the murders, the Shorts spent a quiet evening at home. As we discussed earlier, Chris Thompson was at the Shorts' home working on the work truck with Michael, and we don't know exactly when Thompson arrived or when he left for the night. At around 11 p.m., surveillance video captured the Short family at the drive-thru of a nearby Burger King. We do not know if all three family members were in the vehicle or if Thompson was with them. Our timeline stops after Burger King. Most reporting assumes the family returned home, ate their food, and went to bed. Analysis of the crime scene led investigators to conclude that Mary was asleep in the bedroom she shared with Michael. Michael, however, appeared to have fallen asleep on the couch in the garage, likely while watching television. Family friends report that it was common for Michael to crash in front of the TV in his man cave, especially on hot Virginia summer nights. Also, Michael snored loudly, keeping Mary awake. He often slept in the garage so his wife could get a sound sleep. Friends and family also claim there were no domestic problems between he and Mary. No reason to believe Michael would sleep in the garage because of a dispute. The fact that the garage door was open when Chris Thompson arrived gives rise to a question. Who left the door open? Was it Michael trying to keep cool, or did the killer or killers leave it open on their way out? This is one of several questions that remain unanswered. As expected, law enforcement has kept a very tight lid on the information in this case.
Almost immediately, an Amber Alert went out for Jennifer Short. A massive search effort followed, using every resource available. Helicopters conducted an aerial search, and searchers scoured the area on foot, horseback, and ATVs while boats dragged the nearby docks. Search and rescue dogs alerted to Jennifer's scent in multiple locations, at home and in places that Jennifer visited regularly. Besides her home, the dogs located her scent at both the Circle C Motel and the convenience store next door to the home. According to the podcast True Crime Garage, the hits did not surprise police. They expected the dogs to alert at these locations and did not, quote, consider the hits significant. The search for Jennifer continued through Friday, August 16th. The FBI was called in to assist, in addition to Virginia and North Carolina state troopers. A neighborhood canvas turned up no new information. Despite the area being a place where drug addicts and transients congregated, police were unable to identify any suspicious individuals. There was no sign of Jennifer, and police had no suspects, yet they held out hope that the little girl would be found safe. By Friday afternoon, authorities were convinced that Jennifer was not in the immediate vicinity. The search was called off on Saturday, the 17th, with the various agencies no closer to finding the 9-year-old. without knowing what happened to Jennifer, they were less able to pinpoint the motive for killing her parents. Search leaders knew they needed to keep looking for Jennifer, but they had no evidence to indicate in which direction they should focus their efforts. Their first priority was to find the girl, and police kept a lid on information, believing that the killer and abductor might be following the case. The last thing they wanted was to tip him off by releasing too much detail to the public. Henry County Sheriff Harold Frank Cassell had a theory about Jennifer's disappearance. He told the press that he believed she was taken from her bed very quickly after the abductor dispatched both of her parents. As we stated previously, there are several questions to which we do not have answers. We do not know which of Jennifer's parents was shot first. We also do not know if anyone in the area heard shots on the night in question.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
A week after it began, the hunt for Jennifer Short reached a dead end. There were no leads and no suspects in the crimes. The agencies involved continued searching for weeks with no sign of the child. Tips were coming in nationally from the Amber Alert, but nothing proved fruitful. In the meantime, detectives kept working on the murder investigation. They interviewed family members, friends, and Michael's employees. In fact, the Secret Service sent Spanish-speaking agents in to question some of Michael's former employees. But again, no suspects emerged, and police were at a loss. Interviews with friends and family turned up some information about the Shorts. The family was under financial strain. Michael's moving company was not bringing in much money, and Michael was considering moving the family to South Carolina. In fact, Michael had already researched the area and was convinced he could generate more business in the Palmetto State. The Shorts' house was for sale at the time of their deaths. 10 days prior to the murders, Michael met with realtor Marlene Dalton. Michael told her that he planned to sell the house and move the family into a trailer home to save some money. Police discovered that the realtor held at least one open house, providing a prime opportunity for someone to case the home and learn about the layout, including the location of the phone lines. Assisting law enforcement with the investigation and the search for Jennifer, the FBI generated a profile of behaviors that they believed the suspect would exhibit. First, the offender would have made a hasty departure from the area after the murders. Second, the unsub would have changed his habits significantly after the crime, including an increase in alcohol consumption, drug use, or smoking. Also, they advised police to look for changes in physical appearance, including but not limited to growth of facial hair or a drastic haircut. Finally, they said that the offender would demonstrate a, quote, unnatural obsession with publicity surrounding the murders.
Michael and Mary's funeral took place before police were able to locate Jennifer. They filmed the funeral, hoping to spot anyone who stood out as suspicious. We have no information on whether they captured any persons of interest on film. As with so many facts in this case, details of the forensic investigation have been kept under wraps. We do know that Henry County Sheriff's Lieutenant Curtis Spence told Fox 8 News that the house was pristine, a showpiece staged to sell. Spence advised that the crime scene investigators remained in the house for 2 weeks, collecting evidence and fingerprinting every surface they could think of, including the walls. Fox News 8 reported that prints, as well as hairs, were recovered from an unknown individual. On August 26, 2002, Sheriff Cassell told the press that DNA was recovered from the scene. However, he would not provide any details as to the nature or location of the DNA. Fox 8 News acquired some information as to what was recovered from the scene. Through affidavits and search warrants, they learned that detectives seized 138 items from the home, including two 22 caliber shell casings found near the bodies. Additional items seized included the Shorts rifle, shotgun, and the bag of cash from the kitchen. Initial reporting on the case claimed detectives found two additional items of interest, a note lying on the kitchen table, and printing on the window, likely by a finger, that said, "I'm glad to see." The contents of the note were not disclosed to the public. The note was allegedly sent to the FBI for analysis. Since the beginning, reports have neither confirmed nor mentioned the existence of either of these two writings. It is possible that these claims are either the result of rumors, or if they existed, were deemed insignificant to the investigation. On August 22, 2002, the Roanoke Times reported that deputies seized an answering machine tape with an obscene message. Local officials were unable to make out what exactly was said on the tape, and they sent it to the FBI for enhancement. Again, we have no further information about this message. 2 weeks into the investigation, there was still no sign of Jennifer Short, and police were no closer to making an arrest in Michael and Mary's murders. In early September, Henry County ordered the exhumation of Michael Short. His body was sent to the Virginia State Medical Examiner for testing. According to one local news publication, court records state that the purpose of the exhumation was to, quote, correct an error and collect hairs not gathered at autopsy. Paternity was an important factor in the investigation. Detectives were aware of the fact that child abductions are often the result of a custody dispute. According to True Crime Garage, Sheriff Cassell publicly confirmed the reason for the exhumation, to collect the hair samples, but also stated they could not yet establish whether Michael Short was Jennifer's biological father.
Eddie Albert lived on Grogan Road in Stoneville, North Carolina, with his family. And Stoneville is located in Rockingham County, 30 miles south of Oak Level, Virginia. On September 25th, nearly 6 weeks after the shootings, Albert found his dogs in the backyard playing with a wig. He took the wig from the dogs and threw it in the trash. Albert's 20-year-old grandson later found a tennis shoe. A few days later, Albert's daughter Lisa found teeth that she assumed were from an animal. Shortly after that, Albert saw the dogs playing with a turtle shell. As he approached, he noticed that the shell had hair attached to it. Of course, it wasn't a turtle shell. It was part of a human skull. Albert called the authorities when he realized what his dogs had turned up. Rockingham County Sheriff's deputies arrived at the scene and emptied a pond on Albert's property. They found more human bones scattered near the area. The skull was from a young person or child. Fragments of jaw, teeth, and other bones were strewn near the pond. Rockingham County sent hairs from the skull back to Henry County for testing, but they were unable to identify the donor. Henry County sent the samples to the state lab in Roanoke, who concluded the hairs belonged to Jennifer Short. A paternity test finally confirmed that Michael Short was indeed Jennifer's biological father, ruling out any kind of custody dispute as the reason for her abduction. Investigators surmised that someone dumped Jennifer's body off a bridge and into a stream on Albert's property. According to our sources, only 25 to 30% of Jennifer's remains were ever recovered. During autopsy, the medical examiner found that Jennifer, like her parents, received a single gunshot to the head. The caliber of the weapon used is unknown to the public. Rockingham County Sheriff Samuel Page refused to comment publicly on whether they found evidence that Jennifer was sexually assaulted or otherwise injured. He also refused to comment on whether the body was killed at the dump site or elsewhere before disposing of the body in or near the pond. There are other details that we do not know about the scene or Jennifer's death. We do not know if any of Jennifer's clothing was recovered, other than the tennis shoe found by Eddie Albert's grandson. We also do not know when precisely Jennifer died. Her remains were skeletonized, indicating that she was killed sometime before the Alberts found her remains.
As far as police could tell, the Shorts had no enemies. No one knew of anyone with a grudge against Michael or Mary. Friends and family reported that the family was never involved in any drama whatsoever. Chris Thompson was questioned and re-questioned about the murders. At all times, police found him cooperative, and as far as we know, do not consider him a viable suspect. On October 5th, 2002, the News Leader published an article stating that although no arrests had been made in the case, police wanted to interview a 66-year-old man from Rockingham County. The man's name was Garrison Bowman. Bowman came to the attention of police through a tip received on August 18th, 3 days after the murders, from a man named Gary Lemons. Lemons was Bowman's landlord. He reported that before the murders, Bowman told him that he hired a moving company from Virginia to move one of his mobile homes. The company never fulfilled the contract, and Bowman told Lemons that the company needed to either move the home or refund his money. If they did not, Lemons claimed that Bowman told him he would have to, quote, kill the son of a bitch. Lemons reported that on August 15th, the night of the murders, he went to confront Bowman about something. He told police that Bowman met him on the property with a gun and ordered him to leave the premises. Lemons also claimed that days before the murders, he witnessed Bowman drilling holes in the floor of a passenger section of his Ford Alkaline van. Lemons claimed that Bowman installed a false floor in the van. Finally, Lemons told police that Bowman moved to Canada the day after the Shorts were killed. Before his departure, Bowman gave away $10,000 worth of carpentry tools and moved one of his mobile homes to a location on Webster Road.
Let me finish up because I think Alex cut out. The location was less than a mile from Eddie Albert's property on Grogan Road. Lemons was not the only person to point the finger at Garrison Bowman. A year after the crimes, a man named Timothy Sampson made an anonymous call to Rockingham County, reporting that he and two friends saw a man fitting Bowman's description at the Shorts' home on the night of the shootings. He advised that he and the other two men, Jerry Mills and Tony Epperson, were in the neighborhood looking for homes to burglarize. Sampson claimed that they heard gunshots and soon saw a man resembling Abraham Lincoln leaving the Shorts' home, carrying a small child in a nightgown. Rockingham County deputies searched Bowman's former home on Lemon's property. During the search, they found a map with an X drawn on it. Early reporting on the case claimed that the X was in the exact location of the Short home. Bowman learned from friends that authorities wanted to speak with him, and he contacted the FBI. Bowman denied any involvement in the killings and denied knowing either Michael or Mary Short, and claimed he was not familiar with Oak Level, Virginia. Bowman was cooperative, telling agents where he was and how to contact him. Conversations between Bowman and the FBI took place within days of the shootings, and investigators were satisfied with Bowman's response. When Jennifer's body turned up less than a mile from Bowman's mobile home on Webster Road, law enforcement turned their attention back onto the 66-year-old. With the help of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Bowman was arrested in Inuvik, a town in the Arctic Circle in Canada's Northwest Territories. Bowman had a prior arrest in the United States for driving while intoxicated. When he moved, he failed to disclose the arrest to the Canadian government. Finding Bowman in violation of Canadian immigration law, Canadian police held Bowman for deportation back to North Carolina. While detained, U.S. authorities flew to Canada to question Bowman in the Short case. Again, Bowman denied involvement in or knowledge about the shootings. On October 15, 2002, Bowman was deported. By October 22nd, he was in custody in Virginia. Bowman denied everything that Lemons told police. He claimed he never hired a Virginia moving company, never had a conversation with his landlord about killing the mover, and never pulled a gun on Lemons. In fact, Bowman assured authorities that he did not and never had owned a gun. As for the false bottom Lemons claimed he saw Bowman installing, Bowman told investigators that he did not have the first idea about how to build something like that.
Bowman told police that he planned his move to Canada months before he left. He admitted that the timing looked suspicious, but guaranteed that he visited Canada and Alaska several times before he made the decision to relocate to Inuvik. When asked why Lemons would lie, Bowman explained that his landlord was angry at him for leaving. He had been renting Lemons' property for 10 years, and the move left Lemons without rental income. Additionally, Lemons was angry that Bowman gave his mobile home to a friend rather than leaving it to him. A Virginia federal judge ruled that police could hold Bowman until he appeared in front of the grand jury. Bowman testified on his own behalf, adhering to the story that Lemons lied about everything. With no hard evidence connecting him to the crimes, the grand jury voted against indictment. After, the prosecution and defense both moved to have Bowman released from custody. After his release, Bowman remained in contact with authorities and never tried to dodge their questions. Bowman remained a suspect while law enforcement continued to investigate Lemon's claims. Police examined the Ford van and found zero evidence that the floor had been modified. Additionally, they searched Michael Short's records and found no paperwork indicating a contract between he and Garrison Bowman. The map with the X was not exactly as the media described. The map did have an X marked on it, but the location of that X was about 5 miles away from the Short home. These discoveries cast doubt on Lemon's story, as well as on Bowman's guilt. In 2005, the case against Garrison Bowman disintegrated when police determined that Sampson, Mills, and Epperson lied to police and to the grand jury about their sighting of Bowman at the Short residence on August 15th. All three men were indicted for conspiracy, perjury, and giving false information to police in a fraudulent attempt to collect the reward money in the Short case. Moreover, WFMY News 2 reported that Sampson and Mills were also charged with making death threats against two of the officers in the case.
Also in 2005, law enforcement assembled the Jennifer Renee Short Task Force to continue a focused investigation of the case. The task force contained FBI agents, investigators from the Virginia State Police, and the Henry County and Rockingham County Sheriff's Offices, as well as an ATF agent. The team met monthly, reviewing more than 3,000 tips and re-interviewing witnesses. In 2006, a scandal within the Henry County Sheriff's Department threatened to taint the Short investigation. Sheriff Castle and 12 of his deputies were indicted on racketeering charges. The officers ran a criminal enterprise from within the department that included dealing marijuana, crack cocaine, and ketamine. In addition to drug activity, the officers were charged with money laundering. The indictments disgraced the Henry County Sheriff's Office. Cassell was convicted and sentenced to 8 months in prison. Upon his removal, Deputy Lance Perry took over as sheriff and has done his best to restore the agency's reputation. At the time, Perry told the press he had no reason to believe that the Short investigation was in any way compromised during Cassell's tenure. In 2007, the Martinsville Bulletin reported that police were looking into multiple persons of interest in the case. Sheriff Perry did not divulge any further information on the individuals being investigated, but did state that Garrison Bowman was no longer considered a suspect. The FBI, however, was not ready to entirely rule him out, but agreed that the time had come to direct the investigation elsewhere. As we know, Michael was looking for a job in South Carolina before he was killed. The FBI questioned any information on persons who had contact with Michael Short about employment or relocation. The FBI updated the website again in February 2009 to include a sketch of a flatbed truck seen parked outside the Short home on the morning of August 15th. The website described the truck as a 1998 to 2002 white single cab, 2-ton flatbed truck with wooden rails. A sketch of the driver was added a month later, depicting a man possibly in his 40s with a weathered complexion and wearing a baseball cap.
The Short investigation has remained active over the decades. In 2010, the task force scheduled interviews in each of the cities visited by Michael Short during the summer of 2002 when he was looking to relocate. They advertised that they wished to speak with anyone who had contact with Michael concerning the relocation. The broad search for witnesses revealed little to nothing new. Garrison Bowman passed away in 2014. Although officials doubt that Bowman killed the Oak Level family, he has not been officially ruled out, and he went to his grave with the shadow of the murders hanging over him. In February of 2019, the house that previously belonged to Michael and Mary Short burned to the ground. While there are many in online chat rooms who suggest the fire was connected to the murders, we are not aware of any such claims being made by officials. In March of 2021, a new task force took over the Short investigation. The task force started from scratch, examining the case with a fresh perspective and evaluating the use of modern technologies to test the DNA evidence. In a press conference, Sheriff Perry stated that they still had DNA, but needed to establish whether their samples were adequate for testing. 23 years have passed since the murders of Michael, Mary, and Jennifer Short. We hope that advanced DNA testing will enable law enforcement to finally identify the person or persons responsible for these crimes. There is so much more to this case than we have discussed here, and we plan to cover as much as possible during the discussion and the scrum. Before we move on, however, we want to encourage anyone with any information about this case to come forward. Every detail counts. If you or someone you know has any information, please reach out to one of the following organizations. You may call the FBI tip line at 1-800-225-5324 or Crime Stoppers at 1-276-632-7463.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, let's get over to the doc and hear what he has to say about the Short family murders.
Well, I'm pulling double duty tonight, guys. How did I do? I was doing the slides there. You got the hang of it eventually. What do I think about this case? I don't think I'm going to be blowing anyone's mind today. I think what's most important is we have a triple homicide here. What was the motive? What type of crime was it? Okay, so we have a single gunshot wound, killed the male of the house, the father figure. The single gunshot wound killed the mother figure. Child is abducted. We don't really know when the child was killed, but it's when you look at it this way, the time and the effort was put into taking the child. Mother, father, just dispatched. There's no rage here. In fact, I'm amazed, really, that there's just one shot to the head. Thinking about doing something like this, you'd think you want to put a few in there. But this person, I don't even think he's really that motivated to kill mother and father. It's just more getting them out of the way. Maybe he thinks, hey, there's a chance they could survive. Who knows how confident he is. But the point is, they're not going to do anything. They're quickly taken care of, and child is taken. And why is child taken? It's a sex crime. We don't know exactly what type of sexual predator, other than to say it's probably a pedophile. Now, not all child molesters are pedophiles. Not all pedophiles are child molesters. And I'd be happy to talk about that more later if you have some questions about it. For our purposes, doesn't really matter. Would this offender sexually abuse other children? Of course he would. He's very brazen too. So if would this be a potential serial offender, whether it's the serial child sex offender or a serial killer? Yeah, I think it's certainly possible. But that's the type of crime that we're dealing with here. Where would I look? I would start with those motels around, because we know that the house is kind of remote, but what's by the hotels? There's these bug lamps for degenerate weirdos, right? And is this guy an addict? I mean, that's likely to. You have a whole section of people over here that you want to look at first. What else can we presume about the suspect? Well, he has a car. I don't really know. I want to say he seems capable with a firearm, but I don't believe we talked about the proximity of the guns. Like, he'd gone right up to them in bed and shot them. Doesn't really take much of a marksman, does it? And that appears to be the case. I just wonder how close he got to them. So I don't want to go off too much on that. However, also the telephone wires being cut, seems like there's more planning gone into this. There's been some thought. It's not just opportunistic. It's not just, oh, look at that little girl. I'm going to get her now, or I'm going to get her in an hour. I don't really see that here. I think this is someone who's been watching this house and watching this family for a while, knows their habits, and developing a very strong fantasy about this little girl. And he starts thinking, well, how am I going to do this? Goes over to the house at some point whether under a ruse, pretending to be someone who's like a friend of the family, or maybe viewing the house, or goes over there separately. But the point is that he's planned this out. We know this by the methodical execution and cutting of the telephone wires. Typically, people tend to dump bodies away from where they live. So though it is compelling that the body was supposedly found near the trailer of one of the suspects or near the home of one of the suspects, behaviorally doesn't really make a lot of sense. I think it would be more likely that the offender would live closer to where the crime occurred, where the murders occurred, and where the home invasion occurred, and he would dump farther away from his home. So with that, I don't want to go in anymore because I want to have some discussion here. So we'll bring up Cloyd, Susanna, bring back Alex and Morph, and we'll get the discussion going here. Coming up, guys.
Hey, guys.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
Stressed? Doing everything. Yeah.
It. You did a good job, Lee.
I got the hang of it.
Yep. Good work.
Yeah. So I know that wasn't really that insightful, but that's what I got. And in case you like, you can't really know that much more about the nature of the sexual homicide because of the level of decay and such. So yeah, it's a child sex crime. She was the victim, the intended victim. But did I miss anything? Did I get anything wrong? What do you guys think about the phone lines being cut?
Well, obviously it was planned in advance and took some premeditation. The other thing, as far as it being a guy showing up to pretending to be a person who's a friend of the family or something, we know it's after 11 p.m. on a Wednesday. So, I mean, it's probably in the middle of the night. The girl's in bed. They probably are planning on working there. He probably went in there and either the door was unlocked or maybe the garage door was open because maybe it was hot. And he was laying on the couch, the father, and he just went up and used a .22. And the thing you got to remember is a .22, especially a pistol, that makes very little noise. You could be right next door and not hear it. You know, you could be in another room and not hear it. So, I mean, it's very quiet. One shot to the head is going to be effective. Go in the thing, get the other shot in the head to the mother, and then abduct the little girl. And of course, I agree 100% or 1,000%. She's the target of this whole thing. He's fantasized about her, and that's who he's there for. Because he just wanted to get rid. They were just in the way, and so he just wanted to get rid of her. And that's what happened. He took her that way.
Yeah. Point of clarification, Cloyd. I agree with you. He certainly didn't go up to the house and pretend he was a friend of the family or, you know, use something like that to get in. But I think he might have potentially staked it out beforehand.
I agree. Yeah. That doesn't mean he hasn't approached the house and talked to them before.
Yeah.
Maybe he was bold enough to do that. But I 100% agree. He didn't just come across these people that night. It wasn't a spur of the moment thing. The fact that the phone lines were cut shows that he premeditated it and cut it. The fact that he shot them, the parents, once in the head shows they aren't the targets. He just had to get rid of them. The little girl was the target and he took her. Another thing I want to point out is skeletonization. In August in Virginia, it's hot and it takes very little time for a body to skeletonize, just a couple days. And then you're going to have animals scavenging the body if he dumps it outside. And so, and you'll never know for sure. You can never show if there was a sexual assault in this case because there's just not enough of her left, right, to see that. But you can presume that.
Even if there wasn't, that was the intent.
If
sexual assault didn't transpire, it was because of a change of mind or sexual dysfunction or killed her by accident, something like that. But that's
the motive. Yeah. And he shot her in the head. So I would presume he did what he wanted to do, and then he just wanted to get rid of her and he shot her in the head. And it could be because it's somebody she knows or recognized or something. That's why he wouldn't just dump her and leave her alone. But that's what I'd be looking at if I was. The thing about the chief wouldn't say if this happened. It's not that he wouldn't say. He has no idea whether this happened or that happened because there wasn't enough evidence to show that. So you can't just make this stuff up. So he just says, I'm not going to release that. Well, it's not. You don't know. That's what it is.
Right.
We talked about a ruse too in maybe getting in with the family, getting to see the layout of the house, just being friendly with them. I wonder if a ruse wasn't needed, could this be someone that was really friendly with the family, knew them, had interactions with them?
Absolutely, it could be. Yeah.
And then there was money and valuables and stuff, guns and stuff that were left at the scene. So robbery didn't seem to be any kind of motive.
I wonder who has $480 in cash sitting.
Why not take a bank deposit?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Maybe, and that's why I'm thinking it's not a shithead, as Cloyd likes to say. I think a shitbird wouldn't have left that cash. A shitbird would have took whatever they could carry out. I don't think this person's a shitbird, and I'm in my mind, I've already ruled out some drug-addled person at one of the hotels nearby. I think this is someone that doesn't, you know, has a looks like a citizen on paper.
Okay, well, let me interject here. Do we know he saw the money?
We don't necessarily.
Because I would take if I went in for any other crime at all and I saw that money, it's coming with me.
Yeah.
But there's guns and everything else too.
You get a tunnel vision, you know. Stress is there. Whether you're in control or not, that stress is there and it causes tunnel vision. And you're there, boom, boom, and you get what it, and he probably didn't see the money.
It was dark too, right?
Now he's wandering around, looking around. I don't think he saw that.
But to your point, I think that rules out somebody that just happened to go in the house. Let me take what I can get. Oh, here's this little girl. Let me take her too. I think that definitely was not the case.
The
little girl is the target. She's the target. 100%. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think how do you focus on her and build that fantasy up? Well, it's because you're seeing her. You're seeing her maybe more than once, and that's why I like the motel, the proximity. Yeah.
Or family friend.
That too.
And what's frustrating is we have that very unique looking truck in the sketch that was seen out in front of their house. And you have a sketch of the driver. I don't know how common that kind of truck is in the area, but it didn't look like something newer. It looked like a specialized truck with wood panels on the side.
Right.
I think they would have been pouring over the area looking for a truck and a driver like that.
Well, the other thing is, when was that supposedly seen? What time of day was that in the
evening? Morning?
Obviously, happened in the morning. The morning of the shooting. So,
yeah,
18
before
hours.
The bodies were found.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. I mean, so what? So that has very little interest to me. I mean,
if it's early hours of the morning, it could have been closer to the midnight hour. A lot of the details here were kind of vague from my sources. However, with Route 2220 running right through there, and you've got a motel and a bunch of dive kind of places, truckers might use that. They might not be there or live around there every single day, but they might use the convenience store. They might use that as a truck stop. Yeah. And Jennifer frequented the convenience store a lot. She was friendly with the owner. I remember being a little girl and being friends with all the neighbors, going to the stores. It could be someone who wasn't, like I said, living in the area, but who came by there often enough to have spotted her on multiple occasions.
Absolutely correct. Yes, I believe so.
Before we do more behavioral, and there's a lot to talk about, we haven't talked about the potential message yet. But I want to get to that a bit later. Susanna, from a DNA perspective, how can you solve this case and how could you go about it then and now?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you know, I think unfortunately, due to the stage of decomposition of Jennifer, you know, I think that's kind of a dead end there in terms of getting DNA evidence. So I think that means that we have to go back to the house and the original crime scene and think about things that might have been found there. I would say right off the bat, the two casings would be something that I would want to look at. Now, that's assuming that they haven't been handled by 20 different people, you know, people who collected them, people who did any kind of firearms examination, latent print examination, and that may have been done. Now, it doesn't automatically mean that those can't be tested. It's just going to depend on how they were handled. Were gloves worn? Or even if not, you know, I've had some cold cases where we said, okay, listen, the firearms examiner was a female. We're pretty sure our suspect is a male. if we get male DNA, you know, if we can rule out that firearms examiner, there might still be useful DNA on those casings. So that's something I'd want to look at. I'm kind of wondering if, you know, and this might be sort of a behavioral thing, if our perpetrator was wearing gloves, you know, I mean, if he took the time to cut the phone lines, it makes me think that that's a possibility. I think that because they had that open house, any sort of trace evidence loses some of its meaning, you know, and things like hairs, I put not a whole lot of stock in hairs unless they're, you know, found in a fistful in the victim's hands or something like that. That's right. A little bit different, but hairs at a crime scene, I mean, they can be brought in by so many different methods. Probably not important. The note though, that you were bringing up, that's interesting as well. You know, if that, obviously there's very little information about this note, but if it was mentioned as an item or a potential item of evidence, then perhaps somehow they've ruled out the Short family as the writers of the note. And certainly we can get DNA from, you know, just from someone placing their hand on a piece of paper. And as their hand goes across the page, I've been able to get DNA from something like that.
Also, if there was a note.
There was a writing on the window that looked like the finger. That would be a good spot.
Bedroom
and her blankets and
But the printing on the window could have been made by Jennifer. If these things were, you know, little girl sitting there, you know, writing in the fog and they found it. Mm-hmm. But let me just clarify a little bit. From what I found, this note and this finger writing was mentioned in very initial reports, and then it was never mentioned again. So that's why most of the sources think that maybe these writings weren't actually found. Maybe they didn't exist, and maybe they were just part of the rumor mill.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You got to be careful with that writing on the window too, because that could have been done months before. Find that out the hard way when I stayed at the Lizzie Borden bed and breakfast and went to take a shower in the morning. And I woke up and someone had put an axe in the steam the door is locked. Because I'm more of a historical thinker than a scientific thinker, I went, "Oh, that's not a ghost. That's a double-headed axe." Yeah. And then I went to the science part. Susanna, you could explain this. It's all the oils on the hand that remain on the glass, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Until it's going to be cleaned again. Yeah. Another thing I found interesting that the sheriff was saying, you know, this crime occurred on August 15th. By August 26th, he's saying that DNA was recovered. You know, I've found that some of the investigators that I work with, they call evidence DNA.
Yeah.
And so there's DNA, but it sounds like he's talking about potential DNA evidence has been recovered, because then later, he's saying,
it's like in the South where they call all soda Coke.
I
can see calling DNA evidence, but not evidence DNA.
But I've had it happen before. And if you listen to what the terminology is, you know, and he's saying even much later, in 2020, they still have DNA, but they need to see if the samples are adequate for testing.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't have, that's not a DNA profile. No. He's interchanging the word, in my opinion, he's interchanging the word evidence or potential DNA, or we have collected items that might have DNA, but I think that's different than saying I have a DNA profile.
Well, if they did,
or I presented it incorrectly. That's always a possibility.
Well, it's also hard. We do these cases without having the case file, right? And so we're just a lot of stuff's out there. So it's really hard to know. And then you have news reports and stuff. So, I mean, he did say the news reports. He said that. And also that we have to know if it's adequate for testing. Well, if you have DNA, you know it's adequate for testing. You know, it's
not, that's my point. Exactly.
I caught on that exactly when I read the same thing. What's he talking about? Is it adequate for testing? Because you got it. Yeah. So.
I'm going to go back to the wig.
What made him disregard the note or any other stuff, too?
We mentioned a wig being found. Now, we didn't clarify it. Maybe it wasn't clarified. Was it an actual wig? Was it part of her scalp?
No, it was her hair.
It was part of her scalp.
It was. Okay, so he assumed. So I was going to say, if that is a wig, that could have been a potential DNA spot from somebody wearing a disguise or something like that. But worth clarifying then.
But hold on. With that, then, is if it is her hair, Susanna, could it just be just as good as a wig for DNA?
Well, I mean, you could certainly her DNA. Her DNA from it, but
no, his.
You know, we're.
I mean,
unlikely, especially in the water. You know,
it was in the water,
and for that long. Well, it sounds like her body was in the water.
We don't know how much was in the water. She could have been buried. The dogs could have dug her up.
That's true.
Or other animals they could have just found. The residual, whatever was left over after other animals got to her.
If 25% of her was found in the pond, and maybe I misunderstood that, then you can presume that 100% of her is in the pond, and then it's been scattered by animals, right?
Yeah. Or eaten. Yeah. K62 brings up a really interesting point, and it's something that a lot of people on online forums have raised, and that there are a lot of similarities here to the Jamie Kloss case. Do you guys want to comment on that?
Very, very similar to, you know, you have the parents killed, the victim taken from the home. She was the target. And had she been found dead later on, it would be even more similar, but she was fortunate enough to escape her attacker. So very, very parallel attack there.
The same mentality of an offender, though, I think.
Yeah. You know. Another person that a lot of people have raised online is Joseph Edward Duncan. And not being able to pinpoint where he was at the time, but he was known, I guess, to roam the country. And I know, Cloyd, you did some work on the Duncan case.
Right.
So would you like to comment there?
Well, nothing that would give me any insight into this. I'm not sure because I wasn't tracking his motion, but it was mostly on the West Coast because he was in Idaho and then down in California, which is how I got involved helping out the Riverside County District Attorney investigators who were looking to see whether he might have been involved in their murder because it was a similar MO and that type of thing. But again, I have no information about whether he was ever in Virginia or the East Coast of the United States. Mine was all West Coast.
So what could we glean knowing Joseph Edward Duncan? Is there anything that we can learn about this offender from Duncan that might assist law enforcement in looking for the right person?
I wish I knew that case better. I think there's probably a previous child sex abuse with Duncan, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I think so. And total psychopath.
Right.
So, you know, if you know what those psychopathic patterns are, and I'm not going to like start listening. Well,
he was so old that he had the little girl, I forgot her name now, but he stopped into stores and stuff and brought her in with him. I don't remember.
I don't remember the name.
Boy, Dylan was a little boy, the brother, and he eventually killed him. Groney, that's it. Yeah.
And so, Shasta Groney.
Oh, because he took her into a convenience store or a truck stop or something, and the clerk recognized her and called the police and said, "That's him." So he was really kind of bold. He didn't keep her. He was like, you know, she's my girlfriend type of mentality, you know, walking everywhere with her. And that's what, you know, that was his downfall because Mm-hmm. There's a big media case. These kids are missing, and the guy sees this little girl walk in the store and goes, "That's her." Yeah, Shauna Groening. Yes, right. Yeah, that's her name. So, yeah, that was right across the Idaho border in Coeur d'Alene area where that happened.
So this offender seems to quickly dispatch the parents, grabs the kid, quickly dispatches the kid. That seems different from somebody like Duncan.
Whether he quickly dispatched her or kept her for a few days and then did it, I don't think he did it. I don't think necessarily did it the same night. He probably kept her for a few days till he was done with her.
Because otherwise, why take her, right, Cloyd? If you've already gone to that risk of entering the home. You just
go right there and kill her right there.
Exactly.
Wesley Allen Dodd.
And that's that extended fantasy part where he's seeing her, right? And he's thinking, to do the things I want to do with her, it's going to take some time. And so it's going to have to be.
She was probably killed within a couple of days, maybe even a day.
Statistically, it would say within a day.
What I used to work at HITS, we did a big study before I was there on child abductions, and they found that 95% of children abducted were killed within 12 to 14 hours of being abducted. You know, and again, you got Wesley Allen Dodd that did that and took them as for sexual purposes and his fantasies and then killed them. And so, I mean, whatever time you want.
Oh, well, hold on. If we're talking about other offenders like this, Wesley Allen Dodd's first two murder victims, it's a double homicide, Billy and Colnier. He gets them outside. He waits on a trail, and he has the intention of molesting one or more boys and killing them. Right. But then when it comes to it, he realizes, the outside, he doesn't have as much control and such, but he also doesn't have enough time with them to do the things he wants. So then with the Lee Isley, abduction and murder. I think he was 4 years old, Lee Isley.
Yeah.
He abducts him and he takes him back to the house.
First, he takes him to McDonald's to get a Happy Meal, and then they go back to the house.
I mean, it's a horrible crime. It's horrible. One of the worst things I've ever heard.
Oh my gosh! Yeah,
and particularly what he was going to do the next one. I'm just so glad they caught that piece of shit, Wesley Dodd.
Yeah, but, as he's trying to carry the kid out of the bathroom in a theater, and the kid's screaming, "This isn't my dad."
Yeah, but where this is important is we're talking about what else might this offender have in his background? If there's previous homicides, they might be shorter affairs where he learns from that, and he says, now I want to spend a longer time with them. So you're going to see a similar type of victim. But there could also be, we're saying previous child molestations as well, where that are of shorter duration. That's going to be hard to look at and find, but it just occurred to me.
Right. It seems like sex offenders are the quick thing that they say, all right, let's look at the sex offenders in here, which I imagine they did. They looked at the sex offenders in that area. Maybe he became a sex offender afterwards. So maybe it's worth looking at people
the whole time, but nobody.
On the sex offenders list, maybe he got busted for something else following this. So maybe it's worth looking at people in that area that got added to,
or even in other states. Again, let's go back to Route 220. This is a transient area. Yeah. So,
when I used to investigate sex crimes, I arrested a guy one time who was 35 years old who told me he'd been raping kids since he was 15. And he confessed to like 30 of them. He'd never even been suspected. And he confessed. I was investigating one, but I tricked him into confessing.
Was that Frank?
Uncle Frank. Yes. I made him think I knew about more than I did. And so he kept tossing up one case after another. And he ended up confessing that night, 12 or 15 rapes within a month of the time I had him. And he told me he's been doing it since 15 years old and never even suspected. So, the whole registered sex offender thing doesn't really matter. It's because there's a lot of unregistered sex offenders.
I think the a clue too is the area where her body was dumped. I wish we knew more about that area as far as geography. How hard would it be to get to that spot? Why did he take her to that spot to dispose of her body?
He had to be familiar with the spot.
Maybe he has some kind of connection in the area. And I also think it was interesting that that's the area where they were thinking about relocating to. So
No.
Yeah, it was still.
She was found in North Carolina. They were thinking about going to South Carolina.
And they're right on the border. They're right on the border of Virginia and South Carolina. So it could have been 10 miles away. We don't know. I mean, it's isn't necessarily that far. Yeah.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
In terms of suspects, there's something I'd like to get your thoughts on. You've got these three burglars who say they were just out casing houses, scouting for places to burglarize, but they were in the area. They're shitbirds. What do you think of them as suspects? And then also Gary Lemons, who comes up with this very elaborate story about his tenant. You know, puts this guy's, you know, freedom in jeopardy. But he, too, lives within a mile of the body dump.
Well, this is the problem.
He comes up with a story. Yeah. Yeah.
This is the problem when you have a community of shitbirds and you put a big reward out there. Because they'll lie just to get the reward, right? Even though, so who knows? First of all, I don't think this was three people that did this. I think this was one person that did this.
Yeah.
There was something interesting. The neighbor, the one neighbor that the Shorts had, her name was Ruby Eberson. And one of the three guys' last name was Epperson. And I tried and I couldn't find out if maybe this Epperson was connected to Ruby, if it was Ruby Epperson and not Eberson.
Yeah, maybe there was.
So that's something I'd really like to find out.
That's kind of a coincidence. That's pretty close, isn't it? Really.
Yeah. And it could have been. I just couldn't understand.
I'd still like to find out more about the guy in the suspicious truck, and if he's not connected to the case, rule him out properly. See who he is, identify him, and see what his story is. Why his truck's in the area? Maybe it's just a guy in the area, and he's
maybe got he was with the case. Hell, and he thinks that's the parking lot for it or something, you know.
But you find the guy and find out for sure because
the
timing seems suspicious.
Yeah, you got to know how good their sketch guy was. You know, I had a lot of really good experiences with a person that did sketches for me, but I used the same woman all the time and she was fabulous. Mm-hmm. But I've seen some really bad sketches that don't look anything like it. You know, this sketch person I used. When we unknown suspects, when we finally got him, he could have posed for the sketches. Matter of fact, one time I had a murder suspect and a sketch, and I threw down the sketch and I said to him, "Who's that?" And he goes, "That's me." And he was right; it was him.
And especially the details about the wooden panels on the truck.
Yeah, that sounds like a commercial truck of some sort that is in there.
And this is the Deep South.
I'd like to know what time it really was there. You know. That makes
there were a lot of things I wanted. I wanted precise details about.
Yeah, it makes a big difference what time they were there.
So Patricia Burns says it's also like the guy that was obsessed with leaves and trees.
I don't know that case, but then she followed up with this.
And then she asks, Doc, is there a paraphilia connected to leaves and trees?
Yeah, dendrophilia.
That's right.
No, I'm being serious.
Yep.
Yeah, although I don't think that that's the case. I think if you're doing that every time someone's dumped in the woods, you can start going like, oh, it's a dendrophile. No, it's just that you're not – where are you going to dump them? You're going to dump them in the wilderness. What's the wilderness in that part of the South? It's the woods.
Leaves and trees. So I'm wondering if Patricia can elaborate. Can you elaborate a little bit on the person who – are you saying that there was a specific offender who had this paraphilia?
I've heard of him. I never looked into it, but I heard of this. Oh, was this the guy? I remember this guy. He put all these leaves inside his house.
I know the case and it's escaping my mind, but I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, no, not this case. That's
he was a panda. Eat shoots and leaves, right?
Oh, dude, Cloyd.
We've got this piece of information from Renee Brown, too. 220 connects with 81 to the north, which runs east-west through Virginia, Tennessee, and straight to D.C. and has a lot of trucking traffic. I do think it's realistic to say there was significant trucking traffic in her area. Yeah. I just don't think it's someone passing through.
I don't see the passing through connection either. I think this is someone.
Not a one-time passing through. Somebody that was a regular rest stop. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some regularity involved here.
Like a semi-local driver, not necessarily cross-country. Yeah. It's somebody that comes there all the time.
But it's east-west because.
Well, she said north-south too, I think.
Yeah. Did she?
Well, I don't know. Let's see if we're the producer can pull that back up. Oh, that's okay, you.
Interstate 81.
To the north, which runs east-west.
It runs east-west. But
so east-west 220
runs north-south.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what do you think about what I said there, Cloyd, about people tend to dump away from home? So if you're going to, I think in this type of crime, you reside closer and then you dump away. It's tempting to think that.
You're not going to dump her right in your own backyard.
Yeah, you're not going to go to all that effort cutting the.
When you find your parts. Yeah.
No. The guy who cuts the phone lines and does all that is not going to be the guy who says, I'm going to dump her, you know.
He may not. I mean, away from home could be 5 or 10 miles from home. But it's not going to be close.
Yeah. I should warn people that don't listen to what we say and then immediately always assume the extremes. Sometimes this guy seems like he's fairly professional about it, and people form like a CIA assassin in their head.
Well, the thing is that this guy, first of all, he's got the body in the car and he wants to get rid of it. Right? Yeah. He doesn't want to be stopped by the police with his body in this car. So he wants to go far enough away from his home, but in a short amount of time. So, you know, like I said, 5 miles could be plenty away from his house. If he even lives in the area, like I said, he could be somebody that drives through there all the time and sees her, but then he'd have to keep her for a while. But she was from North Carolina, so maybe.
Right, but she wasn't far from the state line, right?
Well, right. I don't know how far down in North Carolina she was. They lived right
now. Alex, do you remember?
30 miles from Oak Level to Stouffville. It's close.
In the region.
It's close. So you have this sort of organized offender who we won't keep repeating why, but he seems to have planned it. He cuts the phone lines and stuff. It's highly believable that he lives in the state where she was taken from, and then he drives across North Carolina to dump it to create like linkage blindness and jurisdictional confusion.
I agree 100%. Yeah.
So what did you guys think about the suspect who, what was his name? Abraham Lincoln.
Garrison Bowman.
Garrison.
Well, you know, you wonder how much information these three little shitbirds had about people who were suspects. If they knew that he was a suspect. Oh, yeah, he looked like Abraham Lincoln because of his beard, right?
No, I think this guy actually with the cheekbones and everything. But
he looked a lot like him.
If someone said he looked like Abraham Lincoln, but did these people know who he was before they gave the description?
That's exactly. And let me clarify that there, a few days after, that's when Lemons gives the tip about Garrison Bowman.
Right.
It was, I think, a year later when the three shitbirds come forward with their information, and a lot of investigation of Bowman happened in between then.
Right.
But some of the things that stuck out to me, and I would like to know your take on this. Bowman was 66 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was also an alcoholic. Is this something that a man that age could easily get away with?
Yes. I'd want to know what his background is. Has he ever been suspected of child abuse or child molestation before? Yeah. So, I mean, this guy has a history. This guy's a pedophile. Okay. This guy likes little girls, right? If he liked anybody, he might have killed the others and done the mother, right? But he's after this little girl. And so I would think it's someone who's either been arrested for it or suspected of it, or, you know, at least people know that he had that propensity.
Here's another potential prior to voyeurism. Just a rule of thumb when you have crime scenes that take place indoors. I mean, if he's watching kids going in their house and fantasizing about them, he's probably doing it other places too.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, exactly.
So we have any more comments and questions?
Patricia Burns back says the tree guy dumped the victims inside a tree stump. So a different tree guy than
the one. This is this guy.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember this case and the name is escaping me.
Was it this? Matthew Hoffman?
Oh, okay.
He killed Sarah Maynard's whole family and kidnapped Sarah. Okay, well, that's interesting.
You're the tie. Yeah.
Where was that, Patricia? Please chime in with that. That, yeah, because you never know.
You don't?
Ashley says it was Ohio.
Ooh.
Not too far away.
Not too far.
No, at least in the same region.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty a big jump, though, you know, because we mentioned you're dumping bodies out in the woods, out in a river, wherever. It's, yeah, you know, it's hard to just say that person's has an interest in, you know, they're sexually aroused by trees and plants. Yeah.
I think the real connection is killing
the family and kidnapping Sarah. Yeah. So how old is Sarah? Okay. So Ohio's not far. I mean, I was looking at that chemical disaster they had recently in
Ohio,
and it affected all the South too. That
Well, the thing is, this really taking care of the parents is not necessarily that unusual. I mean, not enough where you'd tie it down to one guy. You know, I mean, not that it couldn't be him, but I mean, but the reality is, you know, if you want,
it's not that far. Yeah. I grew up in Pennsylvania. I went to grad school in Richmond, Virginia. And, you know, Ohio is right next to Pennsylvania. It's definitely, it's, you know, it depends on where in Ohio and where in Virginia, but 4 or 5 hours, you know.
This is way south of Virginia where this happened, right at the border.
From Ohio to Carolina, I'm thinking that's what, 3 or 4 states up away?
Was Virginia.
Carolina's Virginia. Be further. Yeah. You're going to go through West Virginia. Yeah. But,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it depends. That's what I'm saying. Like, it depends on if you're talking about.
And we're not saying you lived in Ohio, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you get out of state because you've done one crime and you go to the other.
Yeah.
So I see here that Sarah Maynard, who she brought up, was found alive.
Okay.
Not dead.
When?
2010.
So later.
Much later, yeah.
Yeah, probably not doing that. You never know, though. You never know.
And she was 13.
You never know. Yeah. I mean, think it's related? Probably not, but you never know. You can't discount it out just like that.
So Renee Brown, who's local to the area, said it's about a 5-hour drive from here to the border of Ohio. So I don't think that's a guy coming from Ohio to do it, but I'm saying if there was a crime later in Ohio, he could have done the one in Virginia and not moved all that far.
Well, the other thing is he could have relocated to Ohio, right? He could have
lived that's Virginia, what I mean. That's what I mean, yeah.
Then relocated to Ohio later.
So should we be looking for crimes after this? Or before this, maybe, to link?
Oh, both.
We're saying child sex crimes, right?
Yeah.
You don't just stop.
Where the parents are killed and the kids...
No, you don't have to go that... Well, of course, any crime like that, you commit that because the MO is so unique and it has a victimology component in it. So, yeah, of course, all crimes like that, you want to look at potentially being the same guy. But just generally more molestations of little girls like that. And so if that he's at that motel, which is where I would look first... You want to look for kids that have been preyed on around that motel or people who stayed at that motel who have kids elsewhere.
I would hope they went and looked at everybody that was registered at that hotel.
Right.
That time. Yeah. You would hope they did that. I mean, you don't know.
I would think they did.
Yeah. You would hope. Because that's the first place you'd look. Right.
Okay. So Patricia Burns says Sarah was 13 and he went to her house after watching her wanting her. Yeah. And so that's a discrepancy. How old was the victim in this case?
Alex? Nine.
Yeah. It's not unheard of, but it's the difference between prepubescent and pubescent or postpubescent, 13-year-old. So, it's not as strong.
It depends on the 13-year-old as well, though. It could be a 13-year-old that looked much younger, you know? I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm not super familiar with the case, so I can't say. But if it... You know, I think it would depend. I've known plenty of 13-year-old girls that look much younger.
Absolutely. Or 9-year-old girls that look older.
Yeah,
sure.
Not the case of Jennifer.
She looks 9 to me. In her picture, the family picture, she looks like a 9-year-old girl. No one would confuse her for a 13-year-old. I don't think.
Yeah. No.
Right.
If you're listening to this episode of Citizen Detective, we know you'll want to hear what happened in the Scrum, the Citizen Detective after show, in which we continue discussing this case with our guest. You'll be interested to hear what didn't make it into the regular episode. Here's a preview. DNA, probably going to come down to something like that. And then, but if DNA is in the house, is it explained away because, hey, I visited there a few times?
right? This could be a guy who has like CB radio or police paraphernalia.
The other case, in Spotsylvania case, took a child out of her yard, took two children out of their yards.
To listen to full episodes of The Scrum and get ad-free episodes of Citizen Detective as well as other benefits, you need to become a Patreon supporter of the show. Visit patreon.com/citizendetective right now to become part of our digital detective agency.
So I'm thinking right now, why don't we bring Ashley up and she can give a little shout out to our patrons.
Yeah, I'll go make some mulled wine. Okay, let's do that. Come on, Ash.
Hey, everyone. There's big thank you to our wonderful patrons. And if you're considering joining their ranks, here's the deal. The Nancy Drew tier gives you ad-free episodes, bonus content, and the Scrum. The Scrum is an after-hours with our hosts and guests where the conversation continues. The combo tier contains the perks of the first, plus a guarantee that at least one of your comments or voicemails will be heard on the show. The Poirot tier contains the perks of the first and second, plus access to a quarterly private session where members will join and interact with one or more hosts to discuss cases not explored on the show. Think of it as a masterclass where you and the host dig even deeper into your pet case. The fourth and final is Sherlock Holmes, which contains all perks so far, plus a VIP pass to any special in-person event where you can meet and hang with the host of Citizen Detective. As we grow, there will be a lot more coming your way. Watch this space. Head on over to www.patreon.com/citizendetective. Citizen Detective streams every 2 weeks on YouTube at Citizen D Pod, on Twitter at Citizen Detective Podcast, on Facebook and twitch.tv/citizendetective. Now back to the show.
He really did leave.
Yeah, he'll be back. He'll be back.
I know.
Do you guys have any final thoughts on this before we wrap up tonight?
I'm kind of wondering if they looked into the person that turned in Abraham Lincoln, you know? So, I mean, it was found a mile from his home as well. I mean, it could just be totally done for the reward money, something like that. But I'm sure they had to. I don't know.
It's like, I compare that to sort of in the Zodiac case, Arthur Lee Allen was turned in by someone that said that he said a year in advance of the crimes that he was going to commit murders and call himself the Zodiac and send letters to police. You have to go back and look at that informant that turned him in and say, there's only two possibilities. This person's completely lying and just made that up, or, you know, it's a pretty powerful piece of evidence if it's true. So in this case, this guy's story of what Abraham Lincoln supposedly did, this Abraham Lincoln guy that we've been calling him, if that story's true, it's pretty powerful. But if it's not, why is he accusing this guy and making that stuff up like that?
Yeah, he's somebody that I would like to know more about whether they question him in the respect that Susanna's talking about. Also something that has really eats away at people who have studied this case is Chris Thompson, the friend, the one who found the body, Michael's body.
Right.
People feel that there's not enough about when he was at the house, when he left the house, whether he was with them when they went to Burger King. And I think, we talked about this before we came on, that the public says, well, we don't have all the information. And they kind of translate that to, well, law enforcement didn't do their job. Just because we don't have the information doesn't mean that law enforcement doesn't have the information.
We don't have the case file to look at. They could have done all
exactly.
That.
Yeah. Exactly. And again, I'm wondering about at least one of these three burglars trying to, if maybe they were trying to cast focused elsewhere. Mm. But it seems to me that there are a lot of different people, unless they have focused on other persons of interest, that they have evidence, like they said, they have evidence pointing toward these people, if any of those people are still on their list.
Yeah.
But we won't know unless they solve it.
Yeah. And we don't know whether they really have evidence pointing to anybody. They say that, but do they really?
Right,
right.
Patricia confirmed the girl we were talking about looks about 11.
I'd say that's reasonable, yeah.
Hey, this guy came up too. Ashley brought him up in our chat. Richard Evanitz. I've heard of him before. A serial killer. He was, in January 1987, Evanitz exposed himself to masturbate in front of a 15-year-old girl in Orange Park, Florida. But here's where it gets interesting. Evanitz is suspected of a 1994 abduction and a 1995 rape in Spotsylvania, Virginia. On September 9th, 1996, Evanitz abducted 16-year-old Sophia Silva from her front yard near Lurielle Park in Spotsylvania. Her decomposed body was found a month later in a creek off State Route 3 in King George County.
Interesting.
On May 1st, 1997, Evanitz abducted sisters Kristen, 15, and Katie Lisk, 12, from their front lawn after school. After sexually assaulting them, he strangled the sisters and dumped their bodies in the South Anna River. Their bodies were found 5 days later. On June 24th, 2002, Evanitz abducted 15-year-old Kara Robinson Chamberlain from a friend's yard in Columbia, South Carolina, after holding a gun to her head and then forcing her into a plastic bin. He took her to his apartment, raped her, and forced her to smoke marijuana and tied her to his bed. Robinson was able to free herself from Evanitz. Anyways, so, I don't know, he's not bad.
How far is Spotsylvania from where this case took place?
Oklahoma. I know, I've actually heard that case.
You've got the whole Carolina to Virginia back and forth with this guy, too.
A couple of big Civil War battles in the Spotsylvania area, yeah.
And this case was what year?
Our case, 2002.
Okay, well, this was his last crime? I think it was. 2002, June 24, 2002.
That's before that.
Someone from a friend's yard in Columbia, South Carolina. But he's also in Virginia a lot.
A little over 200 miles, a little under 4 hours away from Oak Level.
When was he caught for his last crime? Was it June that he was caught? Because this happened in August.
Yeah, he had been in custody at this point.
He would have been in custody. Most likely.
He was caught pretty soon after.
Yeah, so he was probably in custody when this one happened.
So maybe just goes to show you how common that might be.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of these, shitbirds or perverts out there. They're everywhere, unfortunately.
And I still go back to, I don't think this is some crackhead at the motel nearby that's looking to score something. They would have taken belongings. They would have taken whatever they could find, whatever they could carry.
She was the target.
But it could be somebody who camouflages themselves. Maybe if they do have a prior sex offense history, this is the ilk that they have to live around and be around, even if, drugs, robbery, burglaries are not their motive.
Yeah.
It's a good place to hide.
Crackheads can still do premeditated crimes too. So I was thinking of the case of, I think it was Jessica Lunsford was her name in Florida. And this guy, John Cooey. Yeah, it was some meth addict.
Did you work on that, Susanna?
I did not. One of my good coworkers, or my good friend coworkers, did, but we were all very involved in that case. And then I got the next one, which was Sarah Lundy. So it happened right after. But anyway, so I'm very familiar with that case, though.
Yeah, so he went
and I bet you can't talk about it.
Only stuff
he's executed. Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well over. But actually, I was thinking about that case earlier because you had said about, they're not going to, put the they're not going to dump the body in their own yard. But, this guy did. He buried her.
Right.
It's all the same trailer park, though, right?
He kept her in his closet for a day or so.
She was there when they came knocking on the door. She was alive in this closet when they came to the door looking for to question her.
Yeah, he buried her alive, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, she had a little purple stuffed animal with her. So,
But the whole range of that crime, though, that all takes place within a trailer park. So in that case, the whole thing is condensed to the point, the guy who would take the girl there, that makes more sense. But this is wider open, the whole crime, really, right? There's a highway involved. And
you have a vehicle, presumably.
Yeah, so the whole crime.
And a vehicle, right. That's the other thing. I don't know what sort of transportation he had or if he had a vehicle. And so maybe that's what I was thinking when we were talking earlier. Perhaps, this was more convenient for him or because he didn't have the ability to take her further away. I'm not sure about that. I'm just, you know, questioning if that's one of the reasons.
Yeah. Where I was going with that is, you know, he saw Jessica Lunsford and watched her for quite some time, like many days in a row before he decided to do that. It wasn't just some opportunistic thing. He built up the desire. He built up the fantasy. And then he went in and he took her. And but he was a shitbird. He was a total shitbird. He was surrounded by shitbirds. He was an addict. He had a prior record. And so it can be someone hanging out at the motel doing drugs and all this other stuff and still develop that fantasy. And it seems a bit more organized than that, but it's not so organized that we shouldn't rule someone like that out.
How about, go ahead.
I was just thinking about drug use as a form of self-medication.
Yeah, absolutely. It also builds up nerve and guts, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was in the FBI profile too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's obviously right.
Right.
Don't get me started.
How about when we go to the scrum, we all put our theory out there about.
Okay. Okay. I can tell you what I really think.
There you go. So if you're thinking about joining our Patreon team and being a supporter, you can come on the scrum and get some inside information, hear some theories, and it's worth coming over to become a Patreon supporter. But I think with that, it's about time to wrap up. So we will see you at the scrum for those of you that are joining us there.
But maybe Morph, we'll see them at CrimeCon.
Yeah, we'll be at CrimeCon. I know I'll be at CrimeCon. I've been every CrimeCon since they've been doing them. So, Alex, do you want to tell them a little bit about the special offer that we have for the people at CrimeCon?
Yeah. So we definitely urge everyone to go to CrimeCon. I've heard it's a blast. I'm hoping I get to go myself this time. But you special listeners of Citizen Detective can save 10% on your badges for CrimeCon 2023 with our promo code at checkout. So go to crimecon.com, use the code Citizen Detective, all one word, no spaces. And these spots sell out very quickly. So you definitely want to get over there and book your trip now. From what we've heard, and from what Morph tells us, you're going to have a fantastic time, and it's really something you don't want to miss. So check out CrimeCon 2023.
Absolutely. So with that, let's head over to the scrum, and to wrap up, just give people a sneak peek at what we're going to be talking about in 2 weeks when we look at the Night Marauder, a serial killer who terrorized Tennessee residents between 1919 and 1926. I like these older mysterious cases.
Yeah, same here.
And until then, thank everyone for joining us, and we bid you good night. See you in the scrum.
Go to patreon.com/citizendetective, join the DDA, and then join us in all scrums from now on.
The Citizen Detective team includes co-hosts Mike Morford, Alex Ralph, and Dr. Lee Meller, who also provides case analysis. The team also includes forensic DNA analyst Susanna Ryan and retired Seattle homicide detective Cloyd Steiger. Writing and research, Alex Ralph. Technical producer, Andrew Gray. Production assistant, Ashley Monroe. Be sure to catch new episodes of Citizen Detective every other Saturday. To contact the show anytime, visit CitizenDetectivePodcast.com and follow along on social media.